thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from Celtic Underground. You are possibly picking this up on thecelticunderground.substack.com. If you are a paid subscriber, you can link your account to wherever you pick up your podcasts, whether that be Spotify, Apple, Amazon, wherever, and you can pick up the subscription feed where you get your normal feed. Just go on to Substack on the website and follow the instructions. Meantime, this is Andrew H. Smith in conversation.
Hi, welcome to Celtic Underground in Conversation series, where we have delighted to welcome, like, a guy I know really well.
Pleasure,
it's nearly 40 years, Tom, since I first met you. Tom Grant,
pleasure,
thanks
Andrew.
So much
pleasure.
For coming
nice
on.
Nice to see you. Nice to hear from you.
It's great to see you. Like, you're looking well,
apart
obviously.
My knees, the rest of me is fine, generally. My knees are suffering a bit from wear and tear, but that's just the way life gets to this age.
Well, with that wear and tear, and Celtic certainly initiated quite a bit of that wear and tear, did it not?
Good days, though.
Good
best days of my life, Andrew. So,
as
no complaints, you know, no complaints. It was a privilege, you know, to be there for any part of it. So, no complaints about anything there, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I'll fess up right away here, Tom. Look, I'll get pushback for having you on because, in the Celtic Underground, our constituency, you would say, we're the older podcast clientele, the more mature, put it that way, the more mature. So the guys are kind of my age, so everybody really kind of seethed and kind of suffered through the kind of the late 80s, early 90s, and their memories of that time and the old board and ending the family dynasties and all that is still very raw. For a lot of people. For me, that means that they see me as a wee rat because I was the editor of Pravda, you know. And I don't blame anybody for, I've read some of the stuff that we put out there during that time, and I don't mind if anybody still resents my part in it. How do you find that the support react to you as the years go?
Generally okay, Andrew. I've never really had a problem. Way back when the original Sack the Board campaign was going, yeah, a few guys would shout at you and give you a bit of abuse, but generally people were willing to talk, to listen, give you their point of view and to listen to your point of view. And I find it very much the same today. I mean, I go up to the local supporters club to go to the home games in Moodysburn here. The guys, we have a bit of crack about some of the things that happened, and you can imagine some of the things I've said on the WhatsApp site we've got and all that. I appreciate people's point of view, and as long as it's kept, everybody's entitled to their view. And I'm one of those kind of guys that would take a very, very big argument to change my point of view, my mindset. I'm happy to listen and go with it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what is your accommodation in terms of the role that you played in Celtic's history? I mean, because it was a very significant.
I started getting into the boardroom when my dad died. In fact, it's his anniversary today, and that was way back in 1979. And I was just a guest in the boardroom, but I wanted to be on the board. My dad was in the Merchant Navy, so he was away for months at a time. So he never really got a chance to get involved. He only got to the occasional home game when he was on leave. So I was determined that I wanted to take up where my great-grandfather left off and become a director. So I started to meet with Desmond White, who was chairman at the time, and gradually said, be patient, we'll get you on at some point, so just be patient. So that carried on right up until I travelled with the team on the bus to away games. I was a guest in the boardroom for home games, and I travelled with them in Europe when we went abroad. So I got to know everyone quite well, and I went on the board in 1985, eventually.
And did you always, I mean, people talk about you guys having the birthright, because the Grant shareholding was a pretty big one. It wasn't as big as Chris White's, but I think
it was when the club became a limited company, I think it was 1897 or something like that.
97, yeah.
He had a substantial shareholding. And there was another guy, Tom Colgan, who was also on the board. I think, if my memory serves right, he married James Grant's daughter. And that was how the old lady that used to live in Tunbridge. That's the kind of throwback to that. And she inherited the family shareholding. And when my dad died in 79, half the shareholding was given to him and half was divided amongst cousins and relatives in Canada and America. So when my dad died in 79, I inherited his half of his shareholding. So hence the kind of family connection.
And did you think then, I mean, was this something you were always aware of, even for your younger days, about your family's
past? Not so much in my younger days, Andrew, because the guys that have known me all my life will tell you, as a kid at primary school, I was a Motherwell supporter. God forgive me, but that's the truth of it. Because my dad was away, my mum was tasked with taking me out to Bothwell to this old uncle, and that was travelling from Cardown, where we stayed in a green SMT bus out to Parkhead and getting a red bus out to Bothwell, and he would then take me to Fir Park.
Yeah.
We did that. I've got my Motherwell scarf. I kept my Motherwell scarf to this day just to prove how daft you can be as a Wayne, you know. So, I was down at the pie stall one day, and honestly, God, this guy behind me, Celtic fan, said, "Where'd you come from, son?" And I said, "Cardown. What are you doing supporting Celtic?" And I said, "Look, I've always supported Celtic. I'm probably 10 at this time." And he said, "Coming for Cardown with a pit is, you should be a Celtic fan." So I went back home that night, and my grandmother, Mary McNamara, she stayed with us. And I said to her and my mum, "There's a man at that game today said that because I'm from Cardown, I should be a Celtic fan." And my grand and mum said, "The man's dead, right?" So from there on, I was given the task of going to the local supporters club, going in the bus and going to Celtic Park from there on in. So that's how it started.
So, God, you always think, because we use the word birthright, you know, you always think, you know, you just feel it's fated that one day that you will be in that boardroom and all that. But it obviously sounds if it wasn't. It really,
I think,
wasn't,
because my dad was in the Merchant Navy and away for a lot of the time. The interesting was only done through letters to my dad and letters from him. Initially, until I met that man, and then everything changed, going to the games on the bus, the Cardown supporters bus, and travelling anywhere we went, that just became the norm. And it was something I was very proud of. It was actually through choice and not actually through birthright that I started following Celtic, you know. So, yeah.
Of course. And so when you front up at the club in 85, I mean, were you prepared for what you were getting yourself in for? Was it always a stadium manager role?
That was never on the cards in those days. It was a reserve game. It was the 6th of March, 85, just before a reserve game. Invited me into a wee kind of private area and just said, "We'd like to invite you to join the board." So it happened that night. And then I know it sounds crazy, but in those days you kind of served an apprenticeship, and you'll probably remember the old boardroom. It was just a big table in the middle with the sideboards on either side loading with the various cups.
Yeah.
And it was all set out with drinks and stuff for the visitors. And as a young guy there, I was given the job of making sure everybody was looked after. And then eventually you're given the task of giving out the tickets for the director's box. So you get to know everyone quite well. But then, of course, even when it comes to board meetings, sometimes I took the minutes. Sometimes you passed on the notes and different things, and that was just you starting off and learning all about it. And it was absolutely fabulous when you started to travel with the team abroad and on the team bus. It was just a dream come through for a young Celtic fan. And I think my first trip abroad with them was to Real Madrid, to the Bernabeu Stadium. So that was just the stuff that dreams are made of.
Right.
And so I really got to know everyone. And it wasn't until we started to develop the ground, toilets, turnstiles, all the old part of the old stadium, that it was Jack McGinn and Kevin Kelly said, "We really need somebody to take part in this and be part of the process." And at that time, I was involved in the licence trade. I'd been in architects' offices when I was younger. So they asked me if I wanted to do it, and I was delighted to give it a shot and loved it. It was superb times, and we started to develop the old stadium and make it safer. And then when Fergus came along, it was time to knock it all down and start again.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of water we've got to put under the bridge before we get to that point, Tom. It like, all sounds so straightforward. You make it all sound so straightforward.
Well, to me it was, you know, just I didn't realise that how much it meant to other people and even to my wife, Angela. I don't imagine any two of us thought about the consequences of how much it would rule your life. I mean, every week we went to a supporters club somewhere. Whether it was Shettleston or Dundee or Benbecula, Port William, we were all over the country. Croy was one of the main places we were always visiting. So
yeah,
it really took up all of our lives. And when it came to away games in Europe, I would be away for 3-4 days at a time sometimes. And then later on, I actually got to travel with the under-20 youth teams. You were virtually away for, you know, weeks at a time at times. It was superb, but that was time-consuming.
I'll tell you a boardroom story about my first trip away with Celtic. It was a European game, Germinal Ekeren. And we got off the bus and myself and the photographer realised we actually didn't have any money. We were going there on the Sunday night and we wouldn't leave Ekeren in Belgium until the Thursday. And it's like, I don't even know how we're going to feed ourselves. So I kind of sheepishly approached Chris White and I says, any chance of an advance? You know, obviously we'll pay it back in expenses or whatever, but we don't have any money. The two of us don't have any money. I don't know how we're going to survive for the next 4 days. And he went up and he reached into his wallet, pulled out a 20 quid, right? Gave it this was for the two of us. And he says, I want that back.
I'm not.
That was on the step. That was just we got off the flight, and that was it. That was just once we'd got down the steps of the plane. So there it was like, welcome me, Celtic. I mean, for you, my mother brought me up very much in the Celtic tradition. I mean, she was crazed about Celtic, but she wasn't crazed about the family dynasties. I'm not going to lie. So even from my days in the 80s, I mean, she had a real thing. I'll be honest, she had a real thing about Desmond White. She had a real antithesis to Desmond White. But were you aware of that antithesis? She wasn't unusual. Were you aware of that?
I was aware of it, Andrew, but you can't let that bother you. I mean, you've got to get in there and do what you can. And it's as simple as that. If you allow them to do what they want to do and you don't have any input to it, then you're just giving the club away. So you're in there to try and influence and do what you can over the period. And Desmond passed away and then Tom Devlin became chairman. So when we got back to the days of Kevin Kelly and Jack McGinn, you had good Celtic people running the place. And I couldn't have any complaints about those two people. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed working with you. I'm not just saying it because you're here. Like you and Jack was a good man. Jack McGinn was a good man. I liked Jimmy Farrell. To be honest with you, I really didn't know what to make of Chris White and the bold Kevin. You know, like it amused me no end. And then when it came to Michael Kelly, he was just a rotter.
Chris was just kind of caught in the headlights because Desmond was there. He was kind of forced into it, possibly reluctantly.
Yeah, I mean, there was a description of him, and it's not an unfair description. The description of him, the Celtic Wiki, you'll know this, the amazing site of the Celtic history, and they call him a private school milksop, you know, and it was like, I was thinking, I always thought he should be in a yachting club or something. He shouldn't be at Celtic.
Football just wasn't the guy's game. He was, it was there through the circumstances of Desmond, and that was really the end of it, you know. Everybody else I've got to say, including Chris, to be fair, in the original days, they were good, honest people, and they'd Celtic at heart. Whether that was the right path they were going along or not, but they were good, honest people. It wasn't until the politics of the place changed a little bit when Michael Kelly came on the scene and Brian Dempsey came on the scene, that's when it became divisive and people people had their own agendas as opposed to having a club agenda.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, but for you in those early days, you know, you're there 85, so 86, we're just about to celebrate it. Like, we'll be like 40 years, astonishingly. Like, so you have a title win in 86, and then all the glory of 88, you must have thought,
if you remember, the 21st of May, Monday night, 21st of May, 1979, Celtic 4, Rangers 2. That was the first time I'd ever seen celebrations in the boardroom. And it was absolutely superb, you know, to win that game and taking the league title that way. It was just, again, the stuff that dreams are made of. And when it comes to the centenary year, I mean, the preparation and the thought that went into that, and the chances are of winning a league and cup double were remote at times. And then all of a sudden, it just happened for the club. Everything turned out all right in the night, as they say, and it was a secondary double to remember.
Yeah, it just seemed written in the stars. But in that time, apologies if you think I'm being rude, and I'm not trying to be rude, but like my friend always described the frontage, the new frontage at Celtic Park, it was like Bell's Hill Sports Barn. You know, and like, because my later years, I would be going up the marble staircase. It's no real marble, but we know it's marble-ish staircase at Ibrox. And you think, so I was getting the kind of comparator there, you know, like, when I started at Celtic, it was 89, so it wasn't long up. And somebody at the club said to me, you know, he said, the people that did that come in with 10-gallon hats. That was the expression about the frontage. Because I think he's ended up paying much more than it should have cost in terms of what was budgeted.
The biggest problem with doing anything at Celtic Park was the mine workings underneath. Everything had to be pile-driven and filled with concrete, which always added to the cost of anything. But the fact that it was just added on to the old frontage, it wasn't the greatest thing to look at, but it gave us the ability to have offices at the park, which we didn't have. It gave us the ability of hospitality that we didn't have, lounges that we didn't have, and executive boxes, everything else in that, I'm afraid, even to this day, in that old stand, that sections A, B, C right through, they're virtually as they were in the 80s. And sometimes I feel sorry for anyone that's got a season ticket in those areas, because the rest of the stadium has been developed and it's got catering and toilets that are good standards. Whereas in there, it's very limited. Even press facilities are limited. Look at what we've got to do in a European night, put a marquee out in the car park. You know, it's just crazy. Crazy.
Broom. It's a broom cupboard. I mean, we used to have, I'm jumping forward here, but we used to have, you know, the kind of cupboard to the other side of the, where the press door is to the press room. That used to be our dark room when we get brought over from the pools office. And then they took it away from us because they didn't have anywhere. The kitchens weren't big enough in the Walfords. So the kitchen staff had to use that. So they said, yous have to go. So we couldn't actually develop our own pictures anymore, so we had to start sending them away to kind of tap snappy snaps in the town. And there was before they demoted me, I was a head of department before Fergus demoted me, right? So I was coming up with the media. I was the media head of department. We had these Tuesday morning meetings, and Fergus was half engaged, as he often was. You know that kind of way, he's half listening. And I said, I'm not happy about losing this.
It's all right.
Dart room, and he jumped up. Dart room. You guys are playing darts. I said, no. Dart room, no dart room.
He probably thought you had his picture on the board. The facilities were very limited, Andrew. Don't you remember? There was an old businessman's club as well, and you went up a staircase into the main concourse above. And it was just a wee hidey hole. But they called it the Celtic Businessmen's Club. You had a ladies' lounge down below where Lady Kelly sat at the door, and she policed vigorously whoever came into that room. And it was crazy. The old boardroom, all the pennants, even from the Inter Milan game and the run to Europe in Lisbon, and all in a black bin bag, stuffed into the sideboards. Nothing on display. Everything just hidden away out the road, stuck in John McClendon's old cupboard under the stairs. Crazy. The facilities were dreadful, absolutely dreadful. And I know there was a load of work done
on
the Celtic end to improve toilets and catering, and then we obviously had to work through the rest of the ground as well. But there were substantial funds done to make it happen, spent to make it happen. But it was still an old stadium. There was only just over 7,500 seats, I think, in the south stand. The rest of it was standing. I think there was 19,000 in the Celtic end and something like 18,000 in the Rangers end. All standing with basic facilities. So it was only after there was the various disasters that safety became paramount and we had to introduce more seating. Hence, we lost the old jungle and had to put seats in just to bring the seat capacity.
Yeah, I was going to go on at that because the Taylor Report came out. I mean, I joined the club in November 1989. My first game, Mo Johnson scored in the last minute winner at Ibrox. I was a Jonah, Tom, I'm telling you, I was a Jonah.
No more Jonah, man.
So that was my first game covering.
What was that? Sorry. Not my favourite person, the way he carried on.
Your signal's gone. No, I know. But the Taylor Report came out in January 1990, and that was the kind of ticking time bomb, especially for you as the stadium manager.
I always remember that we tried to do our best with the facilities that were there, but I mean, if you remember, there used to be wooden barriers as well. The crush barriers were wooden. So they all had to be replaced with steel barriers. And there's hundreds of these things throughout the whole stadium that had to be replaced. If you remember the back of the Celtic end, it extended over the catering and toilets below. That was done with concrete pods, and they hadn't been reinforced properly. So before every single game and after every single game, myself and at least a couple of other engineers had to walk around and test everything to see that it hadn't shattered during the game or was about to shatter before a game. And some of these things were incredible, you know. And we ended up putting a cage below the standing area, so that if anything did collapse, at least it was going to fall into this cage and people wouldn't have fallen through. But that's how bad the facilities were.
Oh, my God. And, of course, that Taylor Report that came out in 1990 said by the start of season 94-95, stadiums in the UK have to be all seated because of what had happened at Hillsborough. And that, compounded by the fact that Billy had lost his touch or just the things were starting to nosedive on the pitch. Did you think the writing was on the wall? When did you think that? I mean, people talk now about the club and they say it's an analogue club in a digital age. I mean, with the greatest respect, I'd probably say the club that I knew in the late 80s and all that, it was like a quill club, a printing press age. You know, it really was. It was homely. It was homely. You talked about people that had the best intentions of Celtic. You did feel a real connection with people because you were all wanting the same thing. There was something beautiful about that. And most people were, like, they were really decent people. The players were Scottish and they were doing their best. People were doing their best. They weren't maybe good enough, but they were doing their best.
It was a much smaller affair entirely in those days. When you look at the backroom staff and you look at the office staff, there was very small numbers of people that did all the things that happened in the place. And when it came to a match day, initially when we went there, the only stewards that were in the main car park. There were no stewards on the ground. It was the police that stewarded the games. And that was a very costly exercise. And gradually, through Russell.
Yeah. Yep. Triple time they got.
So
they loved it.
We gradually built up the stewards. I think we introduced them into the main stand, then into the north enclosure, the jungle, and then gradually built it up to a few hundred stewards to the extent that it's the way it's run now. But that took time and effort and money, but at least it was achieved.
But in terms of the kind of modernisation, you knew yous were up against it in 1990s when things kind of move forward, move back, if you like, because you must have known that there was some need for renewal within the boardroom. May 1990, Brian Dempsey and Michael Kelly are co-opted on. Obviously, that their appointments aren't kind of ratified because that has to happen later. But and then within 5 months, October 27th, 1990, Dempsey's directorship isn't ratified. But with Michael Kelly, I mean, I've got to, and hats off to Axum, but I've got to say this is the best description of Michael Kelly I've ever heard in my life. One of the best descriptions I've ever heard about anybody. You said he could hide behind a corkscrew. I mean, he hated me. I mean, there's no two ways about it. He absolutely hated me. And I'll tell you a few stories later on about the actual when he's his Waterloo was arriving, but it just, there was something unctuous. I think my mum would have used that word, God rest her. There was something unctuous about Michael Kelly, and it was so kind of, you always felt he was looking down his nose at you, but you guys really let the
fox in the hen house. Well, Scrooge sums him up entirely. I mean, he was, you were never sure what his actual ambition was or how he was going to go about it. You knew that he was working in the background that could be as devious as could be, and it was a shame because whether Brian Dempsey would have been a great asset to the club or not, the way they went about removing him was deceitful in its entirety. Well, we were preparing for the meeting, and everything was going on. And the way it was done was they'd gone behind some of the other directors, including my back, to try and get votes to oust them. And they'd all that organised without informing anybody else what they were going to do. And I didn't discover that until about half an hour before the actual meeting. And that was just because I went along to Chris Wyke's office and to see what was happening. And they were sitting and talking about it, and obviously embarrassed that I'd seen what was going on. So there was nothing we could do to stop that, though. Right. When Brian was voted off that night, that was it, end of story.
And how do you come back for that? How do you trust in the people that you're supposed to work in very close quarters?
That's why I described Michael Kelly as corkscrew. There was no way you could trust that person ever again. And there were times when we did things that you had to compromise and you had to talk. We ended up having a shareholders pact between the four of us.
Thanks for downloading and listening to this podcast. However, if you are a paid subscriber, keep listening. There's more of the podcast left.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision, and also subscribe to thecelticunderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.